Hello and welcome to this Canadian Opera Company podcast sponsored by DECA, the opera label. My name is Gianmarco Segato, and I'm joined today by Nikita Gursky, who is a Development Communications Assistant here at the COC. Welcome, Nikita, and it's very nice to have you here today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
We're here to talk today about Jacques Offenbach's The Tales of Hoffmann, which is being presented by the COC this spring for 9 performances, running from April 10th until May 14th. For more information about the production, including production photos, there are listening guides on COC Radio, blog posts, as well as all important ticket information, please visit our website at coc.ca. Now, today is what I'm going to call a very special podcast. What we're here to explore is the somewhat tortured and, not to say, very convoluted history of this opera, The Tales of Hoffmann, which from its very start, right through its performance history up until today, has had quite a journey as an opera. We'll talk about this in more detail as we go on, but operas in general, we tend to think of them as sort of fixed entities, that it's the thing we see in the theater. So we go to see Trovatore and that's it. Mm-hmm. But any composer goes through many revisions and changes. I think the point about this opera, though, is that there's an especially complicated compositional history, which we'll be getting into right now.
The 19th century marvel, The Tales of Hoffmann by Jacques Offenbach, is a real can of worms. Any opera company that programs the piece faces a number of challenges, most of them stemming from the fact that the composer died before finishing the opera. Offenbach's death in 1880 kicked off a seemingly unending process in which a variety of musicians, conductors, theater directors, theater managers introduced their own revisions into the score. They rearranged scenes, they altered the plot, they made musical cuts, they made musical additions, they sometimes wrote music from scratch. You name it, they did it. All of this produced a dizzying number of versions of The Tales of Hoffmann. It's quite possible that no other opera in the repertoire exists in so many permutations. And those are the daunting things. But even before Offenbach's death, The Tales of Hoffmann followed a tangled and serpentine path to get to the stage. When he first entertained the notion of making an opera out of a play called The Tales of Hoffmann by Michel Carré and Jules Barbier, his plan was to write an opera comique. That's to say, an opera with spoken dialogue that he eventually intended for the Salle Favart Theater in Paris. Yet Offenbach, just as he's working on this, was simultaneously imagining an alternative version of Hoffmann for international performance, for the theaters and tastes of Vienna and London. He was envisioning Hoffmann not only as an opera comique, but as a grand opera with recitatives, sung spoken dialogue, accompanied by orchestra. So right from the get-go of its conception, Hoffmann is yoked to two different artistic horses. It has this built-in element of indeterminacy and multiplicity. It exists in different versions right in the idea. In and of itself, that's not even so unusual, but we mention it here because the difficulties with Hoffmann start multiplying pretty quickly, and it's a good idea to catalog all the challenges at play. Offenbach didn't get very far on the road to the Salle Favart. The theater housed an opera company called the Opera Comique, which shared its name with the genre of opera which it mainly performed, under an innovative director and arts administrator named Camille Duloc. Duloc, by the way, is probably best known for commissioning Bizet's Carmen and completing the French libretto for Verdi's Don Carlo after the original writer died. So, in the early summer of 1875, this pretty progressive theater director, Duloc, agreed to produce The Tales of Hoffmann with the title role assigned to Jacques Bouilly, a popular Belgian baritone who was at that time performing with the company as Escamillo, the Toreador, in Carmen. Bouilly, in fact, originated the role of Escamillo. Here's a little bit of a reminder of that role's very familiar music. We'll listen to José Van Damme sing a bit of the Toreador song with Georg Scholti conducting the London Philharmonic Orchestra and the John Aldiss Choir on a classic 1976 DECA recording. Thank you.
Señor, señor, car avec les soldats. Mille torneros, heureux sont entre eux. Pour plaisir, ils ont les combats. Le sire qui est plein, c'est jour de fête. Le sire qui est plein de l'automne bas. Les spectateurs perdent la tête. Apostrophe, crise et tapage, poussée jusque à l'enfureur. Ah, c'est la fête du courage, c'est la fête des gens de cœur. Allons, regarde, allons, allons, songe au combattant, que l'œil noir te regarde, et que l'amour t'attend, toréador, l'amour, l'amour t'attend.
The reason we mention Carmen is because its initial run at the Opera Comique turned out to be somewhat connected with Offenbach's own prospects at the theater. Let me explain. Carmen did not get a warm reception from the Paris crowd. Audiences disliked the show for many reasons. Some people found the characters too smutty and immoral, some thought the ending was inappropriate for the stage, and some found the music too loud. The morning after the premiere, one of Carmen's librettists heard this from a personal friend of his. "Your Carmen is a flop, a disaster. It will never play more than 20 times. The music goes on and on. It never stops. There's not even time to applaud. That's not music. It's a crime, do you hear me? A crime." Pretty dramatic stuff.
And almost impossible to believe when you consider that Carmen's just about the most performed opera now.
Reportedly, the Opera Comique became so desperate to fill the house that they began giving out free tickets to the unpopular show. It was a minor fiasco for the theater, one that exacerbated an already troubled financial situation. Within the year, Camille Duloc, the director who was going to produce Hoffman at the Opera Comique, resigned his post. With his departure, Offenbach's opera was suddenly homeless.
And in trying to find a home, the opera encountered hurdle after hurdle after hurdle. Offenbach took the project to another theater, the Gaieté Lyrique, in the 3rd arrondissement, a theater that he himself had run for a brief period of time in the early 1870s. But almost as soon as he brought Hoffman there, that theater went bankrupt. A friend of Offenbach's, a French musician from an Italian family named Albert Visentini, he even stepped in to buy the place and take control of the enterprise. He gave the theater a new name, the Théâtre Lyrique, and he put The Tales of Hoffman on the program there for the 1878 season, but then he too went bankrupt. Meanwhile, all through the 1870s, Offenbach's health was deteriorating. Gout, rheumatism, and probably a case of tuberculosis had been wreaking havoc on his body. He was gaunt and pale and didn't have any appetite. He would wear a fur coat all the time, even in the heat of July. His mobility was impaired. He often had to be carried because his body was almost paralyzed. And one of his most important resources as a composer, his energy, was waning. A tree losing its leaves, someone said. In addition to this, Offenbach had serious financial concerns. He carried a number of personal debts from failed theatrical ventures. And his situation must have been quite dire because in spite of his declining health, he even went on a tour of the United States, performing his own work throughout the country. It was very far away, and he was afraid of ocean travel. But the money promised him would go a long way in paying back whatever he owed at Paris. When he returned to Europe, The Tales of Hoffman continued to exercise its spell over the composer, and he became increasingly preoccupied with it. Of course, he was busy doing other things. He wrote a book about his experience in America, and he was juggling a number of musical assignments. But Hoffman seemed to occupy a different place in his consciousness. Offenbach seemed more careful, more methodical about bringing this piece together, more invested in pulling it off right. Richard Traubner, a historian of the operetta genre, tells us that Offenbach spent more time revising numbers from Hoffmann than he had given to the entire composition and orchestration of many of his three-act operettas, which goes to suggest just how important Hoffmann was becoming to him. And Offenbach was writing like a man possessed, which is to say, all the time, when he was riding in carriages, eating supper, even over conversations held at salons. Offenbach was not willing to let a melody visit him and slip away. But he still needed a theater. So to drum up interest in the piece, he staged a private concert at his home in May 1879, featuring excerpts from the opera. He himself conducted, as soloists performed with piano accompaniment, and even his daughters were involved. They sang in the chorus. Almost 300 people were in attendance, including the new director of the Opéra Comique, Léon Carvalho, who had taken over the reins after Camille Duloc resigned, as well as Franz von Jauner, who ran the Vienna Opera. They were not disappointed with what they heard. Both managers wanted the rights to premiere The Tales of Hoffmann. Each one of them thought that their theaters would get first crack. Nonetheless, Offenbach decided, and perhaps because Paris had been his adopted home since he was a teenager, and perhaps because for him the Opéra Comique represented a hitherto unattainable benchmark, he decided that Hoffmann would premiere at the Salle Favart, the very theater where the opera was supposed to get its start nearly 4 years earlier under Duloc.
Yet working for the Opéra Comique now meant working for Léon Carvalho, an impresario with a notorious reputation for micromanaging his composers. Tyrannical is the adjective sometimes used to describe his approach. Here's the writer James Harding giving a brief gloss of Carvalho's character. Bizet, Wagner, Berlioz, in fact, all the composers who had dealings with him were at one time or another irritated by Carvalho's mania. Not even established works were saved from his attention. He could not keep his hands off anything. Carvalho now had his hands on Offenbach and the Tales of Hoffmann. First, it was decided that Hoffmann would no longer be sung by a baritone because the company had Jean-Alexandre Talazac, a prized leading tenor, and Carvalho was keen to show him off. Offenbach obliged and completely rewrote the title role to suit the tenor's vocal range. But that was only the beginning of a substantial reconceptualization of the opera's basic elements. Offenbach ended up rewriting many of the leading roles to accommodate the vocal strengths of the Opéra Comique company singers, including the three female parts at the center of the tales. In the opera, the poet recounts his failed love affairs with three women, Olympia, Antonia, and Giulietta. These names are sometimes used as reference for the three principal acts of the opera, largely because their order is sometimes rearranged. So when people are talking about Hoffmann, it's common for them to say the Olympia act as opposed to Act One or Act Two. These three acts are bookended by a prologue set in a tavern and an epilogue featuring Hoffmann's present-day girlfriend, an opera singer named Stella, whose character spends the preceding duration of the piece performing offstage in Mozart's Don Giovanni. That's the basic framework of the tales. Hoffmann is waiting for his opera singer girlfriend to emerge from the theater. To pass the time, he tells his drinking buddies at the bar about these three uncanny experiences he has had in the pursuit of love. A common reading of the opera maintains that the Olympia Antonia Giulietta Trinity represents different aspects of femininity, aspects which are then synthesized in the person of Stella. In line with this reading, some purists advocate that a correct staging of the piece requires that all four heroines must be portrayed by one soprano. This becomes a major variable in different productions. Do you cast one or four sopranos? Though there have been cases throughout history of one soprano taking on the daunting task of four roles, all of which demand slightly different soprano skill sets, for much of the 20th century, the preference has been to cast a different singer for each of the parts. While this doesn't afford you the literal neatness of presenting Stella as the unity of Olympia, Giulietta, and Antonia, it does often bring a richer theatrical experience.
In any case, at the Opéra Comique, one soprano was slated to perform the four main female roles. Her name was Adele Isaac. Blessed with a very high voice, she wanted Offenbach to modify the score to include more coloratura passages for her, more dazzling moments to display her virtuosity. So Offenbach altered the parts to meet Isaac's request, and as you'd expect, the results called for serious high-wire vocal acrobatics, especially in the case of Olympia's aria, also known as the Doll Song. The Doll Song is a signature tune, and it's probably one of the most famous numbers in the Tales of Hoffmann. She's the poet's first love, but what Hoffmann doesn't know about Olympia is that she's not a human being at all. She's this mechanical, life-size doll. The inventor who puts this automaton together, Spallanzani, introduces her as his daughter at a party and asks her to sing for the assembled guests, which she proceeds to do in a show-stopping number, which we're going to hear in just a second. The tune itself has a simple, charming melody full of trills, chirps, and those exquisite high notes that Adele Isaac wanted. As the song progresses, Olympia's mechanism winds down and a servant winds her back up so she can continue singing. After she gets it wind up, she sings even more brilliantly and with more ornamentation. And the tradition is that you actually hear her being wound up. So you'll hear the sort of cranking noise, and we'll hear that in the recording we're about to listen to. And what we're going to listen to is a 1972 recording of the aria with Richard Bonning conducting the orchestra of the Suisse Romande with the legendary Joan Sutherland singing Olympia. And by the way, on this recording, they maintain the tradition of one singer singing all four soprano parts.
Thank you. Alors bon, ça recommence. Quand je dis au secours, mais tu vas me faire mourir.
Voilà notre chanson.
That's the famous doll song, which Offenbach had initially intended as a much more modest, less extravagant soprano number.
To get back to the compositional history, rehearsals at the Opera Comique for the Tales of Hoffmann began in September 1880, but the opera wasn't even finished. One theory suggests that Offenbach's progress was hampered by constant rewrites of the libretto. Jules Barbier was the librettist working with Offenbach and Hoffmann. He was one of the original writers of the stage play that served as the source material for the opera, so he was well positioned to adapt it. Sort of. While Barbier kept the prologue, the Olympia act, and the Antonia act almost identical to his own play, he was constantly revisiting and reworking the Giulietta act, making Offenbach wait as the material got finalized. Moreover, some scholars have speculated that because Barbier would offer so many different versions of the same scene, Offenbach probably got tangled up in confusion over which section he was setting to music at which time. It was a difficult situation to work in, probably made even more difficult by Offenbach's acute sense of his own mortality. He wrote to Carvalho that, "I haven't much time left, and my only wish is to attend the opening night." He was in a confusing whirlwind with his librettist. He was working with increased urgency to finish the opera, and his director, Carvalho, was badgering him to rewrite certain sections that were not to his liking. You can begin to get a sense of the disorienting atmosphere in which the composer's last months and weeks were spent. An Offenbach biographer named Siegfried Krakauer goes so far as to claim that Offenbach arrived at the conclusion that there was a secret connection between his work on the Tales of Hoffmann and the approach of death. Maybe that's so. But what's so remarkable about the Tales of Hoffmann is that the music doesn't really carry any trace of misery or dismay. It's not really touched by the physical agony that was Offenbach's day-to-day reality. On the contrary, the music has a bouncy rhythm and a life-affirming spirit. Take a listen to this. This is not music composed within a metaphysics of gloom. Offenbach's life might have been in twilight as he worked on the piece, but he didn't let this cast a shadow over the opera's emotional character. That being said, the material is much darker than anything Offenbach had previously worked with in his career. An uncanny automaton, a young girl who will die if she sings, a courtesan who conspires to steal Hoffmann's reflection, not to mention a diabolical quartet of villains pursuing the poet throughout his past and present, all that stuff falls decidedly on the side of creepy. But, as the critic David Littlejohn has argued, Offenbach chose the material for its theatrical strength and for what it would allow him to do dramatically, not because of some eerie parallel he felt between his own life and the characters depicted in the opera. And even if it was a decision dictated by romantic despair, it must have been equally dictated by Offenbach's savvy sense of what would work well on stage.
The same savvy probably inspired Offenbach to reach back into his own catalog and pull out a gem he had penned some 15 years earlier for an opera called Die Rhein-Nixen and reuse it in The Tales of Hoffmann. That tune is better known as the Barcarolle. It's a duet for Giulietta, the Venetian courtesan that Hoffmann is infatuated with, and Hoffmann's companion, Niklaus, a pants role sung by a mezzo-soprano. The barcarolle testifies to Hoffman's incredible melody-making abilities. It stays with you after you've heard it just once. It's practically the definition of hummable. And just to make a point here that it's not unusual for composers to go back into works they had previously composed and pull out melodies and reuse them. We think of this especially in the Baroque period. Handel is notorious for constantly recycling arias in completely different contexts. But it really happens all the way through. Verdi was well known for reusing earlier pieces. Rossini certainly did all this sort of self-borrowing. And it just reminded me that even up until today, we have the same thing, sort of thing happening. I'm going to put a plug in now for a really great podcast called Opera Now. And I don't know if anyone out there is listening to it ever, but the guys are a bit irreverent, so you might be slightly offended sometimes. So I'll put that out there. But they've been following a story lately about Osvaldo Golijov, quite well-known contemporary composer, who's sort of mired in a controversy right now of well, some self-borrowing and perhaps borrowing from another composer. So this sort of thing is still happening. Even if you've never heard of Offenbach at all or this opera, you've probably heard this beautiful melody, the barcarolle, probably in a TV commercial or something like that. I'm sure you've heard this, the undulating song a thousand times. It is such a beautiful melody. It evokes the lapping waves of a Venetian canal and the gentle movement of a gondola in the moonlit night. Here it is sung by Cheryl Studer as Giulietta and Anne-Sophie von Otter as Nikolaus on a 1992 Philips recording. And that's the barcarolle. It seems that throughout the flurry of different editions that the opera underwent, no one ever thought it advisable to bring the red pencil out when it came to the barcarolle.